There's furor over allegations the United States spied on some of our closest allies in Europe. But are the revelations really a surprise to our allies? And what's the political fallout? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll discuss the NSA allegations of our government spying on friends. Also, Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius apologizes for the troubled launch of the Federal Health Exchange website. And thoughts on the visit by Senator Ted Cruz to Iowa last week. Our analysts, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State. Politics Day starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again. Joining us on this Wednesday, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Jim.
Jim McCormick with us in our Ames studio, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Welcome to you too, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Well, as a threesome along with our listeners, we will dissect a couple of topics and through other ones thrown in for good measure. We want to tackle, of course, the Affordable Care Act, the rollout of healthcare.gov, continuing there, the testimony of Kathleen Sebelius. That coming up in a little bit. Before that, gentlemen, let's talk about the NSA allegations and that continuing story, the slew of revelations allegedly uncovering details of American spying operations, prompting outbursts of anger from some European governments. Meanwhile, we're hearing also reports, intelligence insiders across the continent repeating, we all do it. Finding out what other governments are thinking is what intelligence agencies do. And at a congressional hearing, NSA Director Keith Alexander said those stories, the ones that originated from Europe, from the European-based stories based on that Edward Snowden leaked information, were incorrect or misleading. Alexander says that the news was based on screenshots of data that were not correctly interpreted.
Those screenshots that lead people to believe that we, NSA, or the United States, collected that information is false. And it's false that it was collected on European citizens.
Director of National Intelligence James Clapper says it's important to know what other heads of state are doing, even those countries friendly with the U.S.
It's invaluable to us to know where countries are coming from, what their policies are, how that would impact us across a whole range of issues. And it isn't just leaders themselves, it's what goes on around them and the policies that they convey to their governments.
Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, most prominent example of this, the apparent phone tapping of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Dennis Goldford, can I turn to you first of all? I'm really trying to find out, what are we to make of the outrage shown by the Europeans? Is this real or merely an act for public consumption?
I think it's a bit of both. Evidently, everybody does it. And everybody knows that everybody does it, but you don't want to admit it because it makes you look bad. And so behind closed doors, yes, I'm sure they all knew that every country wants to know what's going on behind closed doors. But you don't really want to say that in public because it looks as though you're being cheated upon and all that sort of thing. So that all this would come out, or at least to do this in such a way that it came out, and Snowden's the gift that keeps on giving, reminds me of that famous expression from the French diplomat Talleyrand regarding something Napoleon had done in execution, I think, is that it's worse than a crime, it's a mistake. And I think that's the particular thing that's gone on here.
Jim McCormick, if you as a nation have the technical means to spy on anybody, why shouldn't you do it? Shouldn't you do what is feasible, or do you look to what is wise? Should you always spy on friends?
Well, I think you will probably take advantage of the opportunities that you have, and I do think that, you know, given the kind of international system that people envision out there, that sort of this kind of competition, there is the, I suppose, imperative, or at least the lack of reluctance to not take advantage of of the opportunity. So,
what does that mean, though, Jim? Not take advantage of it. Listen to what extent? To a certain extent, but
I think so. This is a real dilemma. It seems to me, in terms of the intelligence community, how much do you rely upon? And the real issue here is that most of American intelligence is from open sources. How much extra we get from this? These kind of clandestine operations is really a serious question for consideration here. I'm not sure how much extra added value we really get with some of these clandestine operations. I do think the Europeans protest too much. I take the point that they are also engaged as best they can. Probably they're a little bit miffed, if you will, in terms of how successful they are with the American experience versus how much the Americans might have gained from the technological advantage that the U.S. has.
We can ask, though, thinking of the personal cell phone of Angela Merkel, do we really have to know when she orders a pizza?
We really don't have to know that, but we do have to know what she's going to do about the euro.
Right.
Any likely repercussions for U.S. relations with its allies, economic or otherwise, gentlemen?
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I'll just jump in. First, I think one of the things that's going to happen is going to be a tightening up within the U.S. here, and more oversight. Although can't envision if the Congress really had exercised its authority, how much more oversight there could be. But I think that'll be one consequence. There will be, there will be this kind of diplomatic distance for a time with the Americans because, as was pointed out at the beginning, I think a lot of this protest is for domestic consumption rather than in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and Germany and France and Spain, for example.
We have the, I think it was Monday, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, someone who should be in the know, hammering the National Security Agency over these reports, saying she's totally opposed to eavesdropping on the leaders of friendly governments, wants a complete review of U.S. intelligence activities, also for domestic consumption, Dennis?
Well, I think so to a great extent. We heard quoted quite often, the name escapes me, Jim will know, the American diplomat who said that gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail, something like that. Gentlemen do read other gentlemen's mail, but you don't let people know that you're reading other gentlemen's mail. And what's occurring, and I don't want to, this may give you a segue, Ben, for Obamacare, but what's dangerous for the Obama administration is that this feeds into a developing narrative having to do with the question of competence. And you don't let something like this occur with regard to gentlemen finding out that you're reading gentlemen's mail. And that really hurts the administration because of the question of how much can other countries have confidence in the ability of the administration to do the somewhat sometimes unsavory things that any government has got to do in order to conduct its foreign policy.
Right. In foreign policy, Obama ran on the idea of doing it much different than President Bush and having much better relations, in particular with our European allies, where as a candidate he was wildly popular, right?
That's true, but sometimes you find out certain realities of which you weren't fully aware until you get into the position of responsibility.
Okay, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. What do you think? Is it okay for the U.S. to spy on allies, friends in Europe and other parts of the country in the interest of national security, even if that may damage relations with allies? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. And I wonder about the we heard Director Keith Alexander, Jim McCormick, the NSA director, talk about the misinterpretation of this. How much of this story is that? Simply European press misinterpreting data, screenshots, as he said, screenshots of data, and then the other media here in North America just taking those stories and putting them out as well.
Well, I think Director Alexander claimed that, in fact, some of these pieces of mega data, as he described it, that is the logging of all of these calls, were actually shared intelligence from these own countries' intelligence sources. Now, there may have been a communication problem internally within Germany or France or within Spain. I mean, that's his claim here, that it was not, you know, the United States swooping down and gaining all of this. Yes, there were some of those, but he claims that those were legal under some authorization. I wanted to get back to a little bit, if I could just make a point about Senator Feinstein and maybe members of Congress generally. I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but, you know, under the kind of intelligence reforms that have been put into place back to the 1970s over all of the covert operations, the Congress and the committees in Congress, and particularly intelligence committees, are supposed to be informed of all of the intelligence findings, the activities. So I think it's a little problematic for me to accept on face that Senator Feinstein didn't know about these kind of operations. Because the president, and also I think it's a problem for the president, because under this legislation that was passed in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and revised, it requires the president to sign off on these kind of covert operations. Now, the question that's begged here, of course, and fair enough, is how much in detail do these findings that he has to sign off on? You may remember that President Reagan got in all kinds of trouble because he didn't sign off on these findings over the Iran-Contra affair. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there is, without getting too detailed, I think there is a little bit of a public demonstration here on the part of some of these members of Congress.
Here's a headline from the Washington Post. The National Security Agency has secretly broken into the main communication links that connect Yahoo and Google data centers around the world.
Wow.
This according to documents obtained from the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden and interviews with knowledgeable officials. By tapping those links, the agency has positioned itself to collect at will from among hundreds of millions of users, many of them belong to Americans. The NSA does not keep everything it collects, but it keeps a lot. That's from the Washington Post. So I guess the bigger question here is who isn't being spied on? Everybody. It's not really discriminating, is it?
Well, it sounds from that report that the NSA might be a little bit out of control. I mean, that would be my immediate reaction. I'd like to see more of that.
But what about in the future? Can we expect any privacy in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that's why, you know, there's been some piece of legislation already introduced by Senator Leahy and Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin and from Vermont, you know, saying that they're going to tighten up. Basically, they were big supporters of the Patriot Act, and now they're going to tighten up the kind of leeway that the executive branch has. I mean, that would be one way, but I think more than that, it's got to be greater scrutiny by NSA superiors.
At the same time, after the tremendous intelligence failure of 9/11 2001, absolutely no administration wants to end up with another
sure.
intelligence favor of the mm-hmm. same failure of the same sort. And there's that attempt to balance security and privacy.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that more than one of the 9/11 bombers were, used Hamburg, Germany as a place where they set up shop. So can we imagine having a domestic terrorism case and then a president saying, but we didn't want to spy on our friends or we would have known? That's unimaginable, isn't it?
It's unimaginable, I think.
Yeah. Let's go to Chris in Cedar Rapids. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. What do you make of this, Chris?
Oh, the fact is that the government no longer serves the people. The government was put in place to facilitate international communications for the general populace, and it's grown so far beyond that. We really can't trust the government anymore in any aspect. We've given these agencies complete power, and as far as reforming mm-hmm. them, there's really no oversight.
Don't we first and foremost, though, trust our government, and at the top of their list is national security, Chris?
I guess it all comes down to a question of trust, but I think they've pretty much thrown that out the window. I mean, mm-hmm. the foreign governments say, hey, we don't want to be spied on. The American people have been saying that for quite some time now. I don't know. Where is And the fact that I've called right now, that I've called this program and expressed a view that goes against the government is pretty much guaranteed that this call is under surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Don't know about that.
That might be sort of exaggerated at this point, but you know, it's understandable how people have these fears. But I mean, consider the world in which we live. If you're like me, you have a cell phone, and I've allowed my location tracker or whatever, so for GPS, so that you know, if I put in restaurants, it knows where I am and can and select something in the area. But you know, if you really were conspiracy-minded, you can think, okay, these private companies have these satellites, and this can tell somebody, because I've got this thing on my cell phone, where I've gone at every moment of the day. I mean, we have less and less privacy in this regard. If you decide you're not going to trust any of that, then you really can't function unless you want to go move to the woods of northern Idaho or something with no electronic devices whatsoever. Again, it's that balance between security and privacy, and it's a hard nut to crack.
Okay. Chris, nevertheless, thank you for your views from Cedar Rapids. Chris, let's go to Nick in Coralville. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Yes, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My comment is, in the international arena, we may have certain people that are allies right now, but things change in the blink of an eye often, and whether it's the same regime and, you know, there's different alignments of priorities, or there could be some sort of coup and you are completely caught off guard and you have no information about what is happening in that country anymore as a result of not spying on people who are currently our allies.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have a problem with this. Okay, Nick, thank you very much from Coralville. Are we framing this in perhaps just the wrong way? We're thinking about it as if we're, the nations are all in junior high or something. and that we have rules in, you know, among friends, but not just junior high, but adult friends, that we don't spy on each other. And that's just not the rules out there in the international community in the world of geopolitics.
I'm afraid it's not. I mean, there is this kind of effort to seek as much advantage of the other as possible. It's not an international system that I particularly admire, but it is, I suppose, the reality of it. And I noted that the director of national intelligence yesterday in testifying, you know, said that, you know, he's been at it 50 years, his intelligence career has, and, you know, this kind of thing goes on, is sort of a normal operating procedure here.
Okay.
But I think intelligence and information are not necessarily the same thing as spying. You know, spying raises the kinds of issues we're talking about now. But if I'm with the State Department or even the CIA or someplace like that, and I know that there are elections coming up in Germany, of course they just had them, but there'll be elections in other allied countries soon. You know, I want somebody who's going to study what the opposition parties are saying, what they might do in regard to foreign policy, other matters that affect us. That's certainly a kind of intelligence. It's information that helps us be aware of and ready for any kinds of change in the government. It's not necessarily spying, and it doesn't really have to rise to the level of a coup d'etat. But you can contrast Egypt with that, an ally who did experience a certain kind of coup, and we need to know what all the sides are doing. So we always need information and intelligence to what other countries are doing. The question is, how far do you go? And that raises the spying issue.
This was my point earlier, you know, that there's in most of the intelligence, and I'll obfuscate a little bit between intelligence and information here, but most of the intelligence gathering is really from these public sources.
Right.
I mean, Dennis makes a very, very good and important point here. The question is, how much value added? Mm-hmm. And the kind of damage when they're revealed, when these kind of spying activities are revealed, I mean, is it worth the cost benefit analysis that any government goes through? Obviously, the United States in sort of a little bit of hubris, it seems to me, thinks that with their technology and so on, they can get away with this. But you know, this is obviously comes home to roost a little bit.
What about the caller's idea that there are no permanent allies in today's world? Wouldn't you say, for instance, the U.S. has Britain as a permanent ally, or could that change? Just referring to what the caller was mentioning.
Well, I mean, that's the classic line about the realist. You know, there are only permanent interests. You know, we have no permanent friends. We just have interests here. So, you know, you're skeptical of every country. It's a classic kind of view of the international system. And I suppose, obviously, over time, over a long historical span, there has been some shifting. But there are some countries in which we obviously have compatible values. And even if we have differences with them, we are more likely to be able to bridge those differences than to move them in terms of an adversarial relationship.
Mm-hmm. Let's tackle the Affordable Care Act when we come back after a short break. But we have a couple minutes before that. I wonder, Jim, if we can rely on you mainly to look at, give us quick updates on some things happening that have pretty much fallen off out of our headlines that we've talked about in the past. Iran, for example. What's a quick update and what's going on there?
Well, I mean, talks are going to be opening, you know, next week, I believe, in Geneva once again. And certainly there's some movement, it seems to me, in terms of trying to strike a bargain in which there would be some easing of sanctions by the West in turn for some inspection. I'm still a little bit, I have a sort of a jaundiced view of whether, you know, there's enough trust. We talked about trust earlier, that this could be effectively put into effect.
Mm-hmm.
But we can remain, I think, optimistic. Certainly, and this is one of the things I wanted to mention, one of the things that the Obama administration, it was just sort of revealed over the weekend, is that the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, has sort of had an interview in which she said the real emphasis now on the Middle East are two items. That is trying to get a deal with Iran. So obviously Iran has become a very important point for the administration. And the second is to try to get some movement, which is the other area that they've made some initial efforts here over the last several weeks in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And some of these other issues in terms of the Arab Spring and democratization have been shunted aside in the Middle East. So Iran, in that sense, is, I think, a very, very crucial point of emphasis for the administration at the moment.
We heard on Morning Edition this morning expectations being low for Israeli-Palestinian peace talks.
Right.
Secretary of State John Kerry getting the sides. And we had this release of prisoners from Israeli jails today. The outlook there, Jim?
Well, you know, again, if you put it in this larger context, I think we can be at least a little optimistic. But given such a long haul in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, I think at best we see incrementalism here, mm-hmm. and that's what the administration can really hope for.
Dennis Goldford, in that situation or in Iran, what is your perspective?
Well, the Iranians are certainly hurting under the sanctions, and you know, I agree with what Jim says. The question is, to what extent can this be dealt with through negotiations? You partly have negotiations because you don't trust them. If you trusted them, you wouldn't need the negotiations, so to speak. And the question is whether the negotiations are in good faith or they're simply a way to stall and delay in order to have the centrifuges produce enough uranium or plutonium or fissionable material that they need. With regard to the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli issue, again, there have evidently been some sort of negotiations for quite some time. And nobody's talking. Nobody's been talking. And that's always taken as a sign that something may be happening. On the other hand, long term, you cannot come to any deal when one side, in this case the Palestinian side, many people on it, refuses to recognize the legitimate existence of the other side.
Okay, Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our analysts on this Politics Wednesday. We hope you'll join us. Continue listening in the second half hour. We want to talk about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Kathleen Sebelius says, hold me accountable. She said that today for this debacle. What do you think? Should she resign? How far up the chain should that go, the accountability? And has the flawed rollout of healthcare.gov affected you? Tell us about it. Has it changed your mind about this administration? 1-866-780-9100. More Politics Day after this short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. Tomorrow on this program, a Halloween edition of River to River. On a February night, it was a snowy February night, as a matter of fact, in 1897, the general store in the Iowa town of Walford burned down. The next morning, townspeople discovered a charred corpse in the ashes. Tomorrow, I'll talk with author Pete Kaufman. He'll recount the real-life Iowa murder mystery in his new book, Skull in the Ashes, Murder, A Gold Rush Manhunt, and the Birth of Circumstantial Evidence in America. tomorrow on this program. Digging up all kinds of things in the ashes today in our politics day with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University this half hour, mainly talking about the Affordable Care Act. And we want to have your reaction to the news that you've been hearing about its flawed rollout. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius taking her turn in the hot seat today. She's testifying before the House Energy and Commerce Committee about this failed rollout of the healthcare.gov website, supposed to be the method for signing up for coverage on the health insurance exchanges set up under the Affordable Care Act. She apologized today for the difficulties Americans are facing as they try to use the website. And in this exchange with Representative Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee, she says she is at fault.
So who is responsible for overseeing this project? Is it you or your designee?
Let me be clear. I'm not pointing fingers at Verizon. I'm trying to explain the way the site operates. We own the site. The site has had serious problems.
Who is in charge, Madam Secretary?
The person now in charge as an integrator is QSSI, one of our...
Who was in charge as it was being built?
CMS team was in charge up till...
At that team, who is the individual?
Michelle Snyder is the...
Michelle Snyder is the one responsible for this debacle.
Well, excuse me, Congresswoman. Michelle Snyder is not responsible for the debacle. Hold me accountable for the debacle.
Okay.
I'm responsible.
Thank you. I yield back.
Later, Representative Greg Harper, a Mississippi Republican, went beyond Sebelius's responsibility, straight to the top.
And I want to say I appreciate you accepting responsibility for these initial rollout failures that we've had. But who is ultimately responsible? It is the president, correct?
For the website?
The president, is ultimately responsible for the rollout. Ultimately,
No, sir. Okay. We are responsible for the rollout.
But who do you answer to?
I answer to the president.
Okay. All right. So is the president not ultimately responsible like a company CEO would be?
Sir, he's the president of the United States. I have given him regular reports, and I am responsible for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. That's what he asked me to do, and that's what I'll continue.
So you're saying that the president is not responsible for HHS?
Sir, I didn't say that.
Okay. So the president ultimately is responsible. While I think it's great that you're a team player and you're taking responsibility, it is the president's ultimate responsibility, correct?
Yes, he is the president. He is responsible for government programs.
My time is expired.
Gentlemen's time is expired.
Some recording from earlier today, Representative Greg Harper, a Mississippi Republican, in conversation with HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. What do you think, river-to-river listeners? She says, hold me accountable for the debacle. You think she should resign, or does that accountability reach up higher in your mind? 1-866-780-9100. Has the flawed rollout of healthcare.gov affected you? Has it changed your mind about the Obama administration? River-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Once again, that toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. Here's a tweet from Dave we just got. Signed up for the health marketplace via phone about an hour ago. Took 35 to 40 minutes. Worked great, that tweet from Dave. So let's talk about this, Jim McCormick, Dennis Goldford. Dennis, why hasn't Sebelius resigned? Why not show accountability if she says herself she's accountable?
I think the main problem is that if she does resign, how are they going to fill that position? The Republicans in the Senate will make it very difficult to nominate. Well, it'll be easy to nominate someone. They'll make it very difficult to confirm someone. There will be tremendous hearings on the program again. And the Republicans are using their ability in the Senate with holds and threats of filibuster and so forth have made it difficult for the Obama administration to fill a lot of their positions. And you can argue that that's certainly legitimate. You can argue that it's not legitimate, depending upon your point of view. But the problem will be, I think, that HHS would be pretty much headless, so to speak, if she does resign, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Jim?
I think it would have such a symbolic effect on the administration. I mean, Dennis is right in terms of getting somebody confirmed would be a real issue. But the symbolism of this sort of most important domestic initiative by the Obama administration is somehow, you know, the administration is admitting that they can't implement it.
Right. And it would fulfill sort of the prognostication of conservative. I know Charles Krauthammer has been saying, you just let this alone. Obamacare will collapse under its own weight. So that would be.
Yeah. That would be an acknowledgement of this kind of collapse if she were to step down. What surprises me, frankly, from the administration is that they haven't stepped up earlier. I mean, it took her today until today to go and testify before the Congress. I mean, it seems to me if they really wanted to come out and admit there's some problems with it and say we're going to really get on it, it has taken almost a month here. Now, part of it was because of the government shutdown. I understand that. But it seems to me that there should have been much more grabbing this by the collar and saying we're going to get this done. And there has been this, you know, I'm on a, you know, a campaign trip to Boston last week, so I can't testify before Congress. You know, and I just think that failure to grab a hold of accountability here also adds to this kind of problem that they have.
I'd like to second that. It's political science terminology says it. It's absolutely crucial to control the agenda. In other words, if you're going to maintain your political power, you've got to have a significant, if not complete, role in determining precisely what people will talk about and how they will talk about it. And this has been an administration from the very beginning that's had tremendous difficulty in doing that. I mean, by April of 2009, with the burgeoning town hall meetings objecting to what was going to become the Affordable Care Act that morphed into the Tea Party opposition, the administration had lost control of the agenda by April of 2009. The Obama honeymoon was over within 3 months of the inauguration. And you know, they had to know there were problems, and that's what's so curious. You know, there's a wonderful old phrase, to err is human, but to really screw things up, you need a computer. And that's certainly what seems to have happened here, but they had to have known that. They should have known that. And why they didn't factor that in, as Jim says, why didn't you get out in front of that and explain what the issues were? Now, at the same time, there's a lot of schadenfreude on the part of the Republicans. You know, they didn't want this act to begin with, and they're in the position now of the person at the restaurant who says the food tastes terrible and the portions are too small. They didn't want this act to begin with, and now they're complaining about the significantly less than perfect rollout of the act.
Dennis Goldberg, Jim McCormick, let's go to our phones. A lot of people want to chime in on this Politics Day, 1-866-780-9100. Mike has been waiting in Des Moines. Thank you for waiting, Mike. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to ask if there what the parallels are, if any, between the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and the rollout of Medicaid or Social Security. And I'll hang up and get my answer on the radio.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Who can do that, Dennis or Jim?
I'd seen some reference to that, that those weren't glitch-free. But, you know, one of the difficulties is that Medicare and Medicaid are, in essence, what the ACA is not. They're single-payer programs. In other words, the government will pay for these various things. Now, that's one of the reasons why, at least going back to Newt Gingrich in 95 and further, you know, they said they wanted to roll back not just the Great Society. They wanted to roll back the New Deal and get rid of a lot of these programs. But, you know, here is a case where this is not a government takeover of medicine. I mean, the tremendous complication of all this is an attempt to build this in a necessarily jerry-rigged way using private actors, private insurance companies, private providers. So it's tremendously complicated precisely because it's not single payer, which is why some Democrats objected to it to begin with. And because of the complexity, it's going to have more difficulties than something like Medicare or Medicaid, which themselves weren't perfect.
Amelia is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Amelia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to actually share what a pleasant and professional response I have gotten from logging on to the website. I was able to have an individual in about 3 minutes in a live chat on screen who answered all of the questions that I had. Mm-hmm. And we were actually chatting back and forth for almost 45 minutes with questions. I went through the Kaiser area, the calculation area, to see what approximate costs were and actually filled out an application.
Did you have any indications that were there any glitches you encountered?
No. No, actually. So I have been very pleased with the process. It is a difficult process to understand. I, too, received a cancellation, but I now understand that my policy did not have all of the criteria that are outlined that must be in place for the Affordable Care Act. And that was very easily understood on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And I just wanted to make a comment on the caller earlier saying it's taken almost a month for Obama to come out and take this by the horns or whatever his particular comment was. He mentioned the government shutdown, but he didn't say, oh, okay, it's really only 2 weeks because we had 2 weeks of the government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
So actually not a month. But anyway, I've been quite pleased, and I believe every American should have insurance.
Okay.
I think it's outstanding.
Amelia, thank you for sharing your experience from Des Moines. You know, she brings up a point that we wanted to get into, too, before our program ends. Yesterday it was Marilyn Tavner, who runs the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who faced the tough questioning. But the focus was not on the website, but on a promise made by the Obama administration that people would be able to keep their health insurance. But an unknown number of people are receiving cancellation notices. And I think Amelia referenced that because their policies don't meet the requirements of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Republican Congressman Peter Roskam of Illinois says that's not what the administration promised.
Can you understand the level of frustration and concern about what many Americans perceive to be a false claim from the administration?
But Tavner says the policy's getting canceled because they don't provide adequate coverage.
Sometimes they were in plans that they thought were fine until they actually needed a hospitalization. Then they found out it didn't cover hospitalization or it didn't cover cancer.
And yesterday, White House spokesman Jay Carney went further, saying in many cases the coverage may be better and cheaper through the health insurance exchanges than the insurance policies that have been canceled. 1-866-780-9100. Thoughts on this aspect, this latest criticism, Jim McCormick?
Well, I think the issue here for me would be, I think getting better coverage is fine. I think it's good. I guess the question is cost that people will have to consider. But I don't understand if the administration apparently knew that there were going to be these kind of cancellations, that there were going to be some policies that were not being covered, why they didn't come out and explain that instead of having the president go out and saying, you know, on all of these different times that you could keep your policy if you like it, mm-hmm. and so on. There seems to me just be a disjuncture between, you know, what some people knew and some of the public pronouncements. And I think that is the kind of arena which gives the opposition a chance to, you know, very fertile ground, it seems to me.
You have to explain policy to people. And that's not because people can't understand. It's precisely because they can understand. They're looking for explanations. And the more complex the policy, the more you've got to explain it. You can't just leave it as self-evident.
Hour is getting away from us. Let's go to Wally in Bradford. Wally, what's on your mind?
Just a little parallel. Several people have mentioned that Medicaid and Social Security had similar, if not matching in size, difficulties when they started out. It strikes me that this great bellicose nation of ours has a long history of really fouled up spending of billions of taxpayer dollars through the Defense Department, numerous cost overruns, deadline extensions, and products that are finally delivered that are terribly disappointing. Has anyone ever asked for resignation of Pentagon generals, for example? This is truly a tempest in a teapot, and if the Republicans can save face by nitpicking, that's fine. But this is a huge, huge thing, offering medical coverage to Americans. It's gonna blow over. It's gonna work, and the Republicans are grasping at straws.
Wally, thank you for your view from Bradford. Karen in Creston, hi.
Hi, this is Karen. I'm calling. I was wondering, has anybody done a comparison with the Affordable Care Act law going into effect with the Massachusetts law going into effect and see what problems they had and how it is cleared up? And, of course, I know it would be a smaller scale in Massachusetts. That's right. My question.
Karen, very good. Dennis Goldford, have you seen some comparisons there? I've seen some people criticizing the comparison. I think Politico today had an article about it.
Well, but you know, on Morning Edition, to which I'm a faithful listener, I mentioned something this morning, in fact, that when the Massachusetts law rolled out, very few, I mean maybe 1.5% or something of people signed up for it in the first period of time, whatever that was. But after a while, and they got some problems and some kinks worked out, a significant number of people did sign up for it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's smaller program, nonetheless problems, bigger program, bigger problems.
Bigger problems. 6 million in Massachusetts, roughly 300 million being served by the Affordable Care Act.
The difficulty is that, you know, those classic lines you never believe, like, yes, the check's in the mail. One of them is, I'm from the government and here to help. And that, of course, people say sarcastically, but the way this has been rolled out serves to justify that kind of sarcasm for a lot of people.
Jim, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in with one thing. I mean, one of the things that, again, I'm sort of bringing up puzzles here. It seems to me, why can't we get some numbers about how many people, you know, have actually signed up or applied or, you know, make these kind of distinctions? That just feeds into this kind of view that, you know, the government is not competent in terms of what it does. And now we heard Secretary Sebelius again today say, I'll give you those numbers in middle of November, I think.
Right. She's saying now, I think, testifying that the data she is getting is not reliable.
Okay. But that just feeds into the whole point.
Right. Hey, gentlemen, we have less than 5 minutes to go. I wanted to get to this point, cast our glance back to the end of last week and get your opinions on this. In Iowa, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a headliner for the Iowa GOP's Reagan dinner over the weekend, in his speech to the party faithful, he encouraged a grassroots uprising against what he called the Washington establishment. Cruz also sought to tie himself to one of the longest-serving members of the U.S. Senate, our own Charles Grassley.
The lead alternative to President Obama's Second Amendment infringing bills, the law enforcement alternative, was a bill that was entitled the Grassley-Cruz Bill, that I was very proud to write side by side with your Senator Chuck Grassley in his office. It received 52 votes, the most bipartisan votes of any comprehensive bill concerning guns. 9 Democrats voted for Grassley-Cruz. But Harry Reid and the Democrats filibustered it and prevented it from passing into law.
Okay, that's Senator Ted Cruz there. So a bit of a contradiction here, Dennis Goldford. Get your pitchforks and torches ready. Burn down the Washington establishment. And, oh, by the way, I'm in good stead with your Senator Charles Grassley of 30 years in the Senate.
Well, of course, that's an attempt to insinuate himself into the good graces of his audience, because Chuck Grassley is a standard bearer for those folks. And he wants to say he's Grassley's ideological and political soulmate. So, you know, that's pretty standard. But, you know, Cruz worked the crowd. I was there. I watched him. He did it very skillfully. But interestingly, there were pockets of enthusiasm for him. But more generally, it was somewhat less of an intensely warm welcome that I had expected. So it suggested to me that a number of folks there, while they're sympathetic to his goals, may still not be quite convinced of his means.
Your view on this, Jim McCormick?
Well, the size of the audience, too, I mean, was compared to the fundraiser that Congressman Braley had, you know, in terms of it was about double the size that he was able to turn out. And maybe that's also one good indicator of the attractiveness of Cruz, you know, across even the Republican spectrum here.
Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz pointed out the bipartisan nature of the gun legislation in that clip he sponsored with Senator Grassley. And that's been a hallmark of Senator Grassley's career, right? Bipartisanship?
He clearly has, you know, worked across the aisle, but he's also maintained such tremendous popularity within the state of Iowa here. I mean, approval ratings over time are really up to the 70% mark, I think is really his hallmark here of why he has had such a long stead.
Dennis Goldford, we've only got a few seconds left, but is bipartisanship what's desired by voters when we talk about GOP primary voters in Iowa?
Independents, non-party people, talk more about bipartisanship. Party people, Democrats and Republicans, talk more about activating their own base and their own partisans.
Okay. Very quickly, we have off-year elections coming up next week. What will we be looking for in a few words, Jim McCormick?
Virginia.
Virginia, the bellwether? You say the governor's race there.
I think so. I think I'm very interested in see how that plays out. I mean, the Democrat now, McAuliffe, Terry McAuliffe, is ahead by one poll at double digits here. So I'm very interested to see what the outcome there is.
Dennis Goldford, 15 seconds for you.
Virginia as well.
Virginia as well. We'll see. Virginia, the bellwether for the coming days. Thank you, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Such a pleasure to have your insights on our program. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yes.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. In Ames, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen. Theme music written and performed by the River Rump Monks. Make sure you tune in tomorrow for Skull in the Ashes, Murder, A Gold Rush Manhunt, and the Birth of Circumstantial Evidence in America, a murder going back to 1897. We'll explore on tomorrow's program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.